Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 6 of the Overthrows podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And Jared, I think in the many Uncovered and Overthrows podcasts that we've done, we've never had this tiny an itinerary. So that's good news, right?
So it'll only be 2 hours.
Yeah, hopefully this time we wrap it up quickly. And I was at the game, the Peshawar and Islamabad game, and it wasn't any use of being in the stadium because I missed that moment between Colin Monroe and the ball boy. I didn't catch it live, so I'm gutted.
Do you know about the full moment, though? Like, do you know about what happened beforehand? So I was watching it, and you were obviously doing your job, but I was kind of, I think I just had the iPad in front of me while I was exercising, and I saw a ball boy drop a catch. And then a player go over and help me with the catch. I thought, oh, that's so nice. Like, that's all I thought of it. And then later, must have been like second last over or something, another ball goes into the goes over the rope. And Colin Monroe flies around to try and take it. And this ball boy slides in and takes this really tough low catch. And then they just get up and they embrace in such happiness. Like, if you haven't seen the clip, hopefully the PSL don't take down my version of it, but I think Sky put up a clip of it as well now. If you haven't seen it, it's worth going and have a look at. It's a beautiful moment. And the fact that it had come from them talking to each other earlier on as well, you just don't see many things like that. So if you're looking for a little bit of joy in your cricket, I promise you, the Colin Monroe ball boy catch is for you.
Yeah, definitely very, very wholesome. And you only got the second half of that. Junaid Khan, the Pakistan cricketer, former left-arm pacer, he has the full clip on his Twitter. So you guys can go check that out as well. And hopefully the PSL won't be taking it off. I mean, they're getting free publicity, right? Anyway.
That's another conversation for another day. You know, if you start me on that one, that's 25 minutes.
Fair enough. But this podcast, of course, is concentrated on the international cricket that's going around the globe. And we're going to start off with New Zealand versus Australia. The two-match test series kicked off at the Basin Reserve in Wellington. And Australia literally thrashed New Zealand by 172 runs. And Cam Green scored 208 runs across two innings, including an unbeaten 174 in the first innings. And he was batting at number 4 as well. That too on a testing surface. It wasn't easy out there when he went to bat. And that is something, this revelation, which will please both George Bailey and Pat Cummins and even Andrew McDonald a lot, because they really wanted this to work. Mm. And here's some proof that it will work.
Yeah, it was a magnificent innings, wasn't it? I went back and kind of watched the ball by ball of it from the on the first day. And I thought that was really good innings. But I watched live on the second day. I don't know what the hell New Zealand were doing. But it's some of the stupidest captaincy I've seen in a long time. But the Cameron Green side of it, knew exactly where he wanted to hit the ball, had a clear plan. New Zealand didn't really disrupt that at all and took the game away from them, really, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the sort of the bookmakers or the win viz was in that morning, but if they got that wicket, you know, in the first half an hour or so, I certainly would have been in a position at that point to still be in the game. And then instead they weren't. And, you know, there was a moment when I can't remember who it was, but someone seamed the ball past him. And I thought the ball's still doing something. They're just not keeping the pressure on him. And he batted so well at some of the stuff. It's very hard for me to talk about this without putting the foot into New Zealand, but we can get on that in a moment. But I thought it was a brilliant innings. I think everyone thought he had this in him, but to do it at this age in testing circumstances, we saw him in England not look particularly good, right? Like, he wasn't dropped by accident. He was dropped because he wasn't quite at that level. And you know, I think KK wrote a really interesting piece over at Crick Info this week about, you know, Pattadar and about teams now backing talent and, you know, control percentages over individual wickets. And I'm not saying that's exactly what has happened here, but I think Australia were like, if we can get him into the side, batting in the position he feels most comfortable in, you know, we can get a lot more out of him. And Steve Smith making that huge change really did help, you know, Australia get onto that path. And in a low-scoring match, he was kind of the only batter who looked any good, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't just batting in testing conditions. It's also the fact that he batted with the tail for so long. I mean, there was a 100-run-plus 100 plus run partnership between him and Josh Hazlewood at the end, because overnight, you know, it seemed like, okay, New Zealand are in this game very much. And then all of a sudden, you know, day two, it's pretty much gone. Australia never put their or took their foot off the pedal thereon. And yeah, just going to give a shout out to all of our viewers who are with us in the comments. We have Jessica Bell, who won't be able to watch this episode live. That's a shame. MD Zobair, Manan, Sigmund Fraud, Arco and Muki, hello to all of you guys as well. If you really want a question answered, you guys know what to do. Send us a super chat. And in other headlining news, Jared, Nathan Lyon got 4 wickets in the first innings and then 6 in the second in what was the first 10-wicket haul by a spinner at the Basin Reserve since 2006. Also, Nathan Lyon has a 5-wicket haul now in 9 different countries, which is the most for any bowler in the history of Test cricket. Had he gotten one in the UAE, he would have set the record, right, for 10 different venues or countries, nations. And to top things off, he scored 41 with the bat in the third innings as well. He's still the cricketer with most runs without a 50. So that record is still intact. And then, you know, just the fact that this is another decorated chapter in the legend of Gary the Goat, who we just recently put Mark's podcast on as well. It just keeps getting better and better for him.
Yeah, it was funny, actually. There's a basketball podcast I listen to, Sam Fassini, if anyone out there is a big fan in the draft and everything. He's one of the best guys talking about the draft. He actually, because he lives in Melbourne now, he actually opened the podcast talking about Gary Lyon batting. So I just want, you know, Nathan Lyon's struggle to get a 50 is now a global issue outside of the Commonwealth. But... yeah, I think what it really tells us of that record is his incredible consistency and also his adaptability to different places. You know, it's tough because of Jadeja and Ashwin both being around at the same time. But, Rangana Harath was a very special bowler. He didn't look as good in non-spinning conditions as Lyon does, right? And I think if, you know, if you're picking them head-to-head, I still think you'd probably pick Harath over Lyon. But Lyon's ability to get wickets in places that other spinners don't is massively underrated. Now, a lot of it is just because he happened to be born in one of those places. So at a certain point, you've got to work it out. But, you know, New Zealand is, my memory of New Zealand is the bowling averages of spinners is something like 50 or 55. Like it's horrendous. And they don't even produce local spinners. At least Australia produces local spinners and then everyone else struggles. In New Zealand, everyone struggles. So again, it's just, he's going to be underappreciated. You can argue that Swan, Harath, Ashwin, all these guys were better than him. But his ability to be useful to the Australian cricket team in so many... Like, they weren't going into this test match in New Zealand thinking that Nathan Lyon was going to take a 10-wicket haul. The only thing I would say is, just recently, Dane Peat and Nathan Lyon looking really good in New Zealand. Have New Zealand wickets changed? Probably not.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because New Zealand isn't one of those... venues or nations where you expect the ball to take a lot of turn. And I don't even think Nathan Lyon would have thought that he'd end up taking a 10-wicket haul in New Zealand. But it's amazing how he's, what, 36, 37 now, if I'm not wrong. And he's going to back himself to maybe go for that 600. And he seems like the sort of guy who doesn't want to call it quits so soon. He seems like he's having a lot of fun representing Australia. And it's all like great news for them, the Australians, in this cycle of the World Test Championship, because all of those pieces of the puzzle are kind of connecting and everything they're trying is working. And they'd feel pretty confident to go on and defend their title.
Yeah, I mean, the Australia-India series is massive for them, right? Like, you know, that's probably the two best teams are going to be going up against each other in a long series. And we know how the point system works and all that sort of stuff. You know, if India can steal 2 wins out of that, where does that go? Australia lost that test to West Indies. And you know, again... they showed weaknesses in this game, right? You don't expect your off spinner to bail you out the way that Lyon has in this game. Well, not bailed them out, but certainly you don't expect your off spinner to go to New Zealand to take 10 wickets. And you don't expect your number 4, who's still coming through, to bat all the way with the 100-run partnership for the 10th wicket, right? So I think if I was Australia, I'd still be like, we're not playing at our best, everyone. We're still a distance below that. You know, New Zealand struggled with South Africa G at times. I don't... maybe South Africa F, it might be the better term, but you know, so there's certainly an argument, I suppose, to be had for that Australia still isn't in full form. So there's good signs and bad signs, I think, you know, within that, and you know, when you actually go through the whole when you actually go through everything, it's a good win to have, but maybe it really was on the back of, you know, Hazelwood and Lyons batting with Cameron Green's batting added in and Lyons bowling. Probably not the full, it looks better on paper maybe this win than it did watching it live.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at Pat Cummins' Australia, yes, they've won a lot, but I don't think of them as that dominant Australian side of yesteryear. They've been scrappy all the way through and they've won things. So they probably, you know, enjoy this bit that, you know, we somehow always find a way to manufacture wins. And I'd say they'd back themselves because this is the last cycle of this very senior, experienced crop. They'd really want to make the most of it. Anyway, Ayush Chauhan, Dr. Ayush Chauhan, has finally figured out what the handle means. Yes, Deaf Mango is my name. Behra Aam in Urdu. A lot of people, they have their minds blown whenever they learn about this. And literally once every week, I get this. So this is not something new anymore. Muki, why do you have no idea why I'm called that? It's my name. My parents named that. Named me that or whatever. Let's go on to New Zealand. So the next best figures for a bowler in this test came from Matt Henry. Mm-hmm. He took 5 wickets in the first innings and 3 wickets in the third. And he also scored a quick fire 42 with the bat in New Zealand's first innings. So similar-ish game to Nathan Lyon. Would you say that in the absence of Trent Bolt, because he's obviously doing his thing and whenever there's like an ICC event, he comes back to represent New Zealand. In his absence, would you say that Matt Henry has now established himself as New Zealand's most formidable seamer across formats?
Was it Matt Henry who had the really bad start to his career in, was it Test cricket? Or one day cricket?
I think so. Yeah. He didn't quite crack it at Test level, but one day cricket, he was always really, really good. He had a very impressive record. In fact, his rise in one day cricket was uncharted because he was breaking records and had the most number of wickets after a certain amount of games. Yeah. He did have that start. And in T20 cricket, we've seen him do well with the new ball. Kind of goes for a bit in the death. And in Test cricket, now he's getting those opportunities that he never got because, of course, New Zealand was stacked when it came to seamers. But he seems to be a regular feature now. They seem to trust him and he's delivering.
But after 13 tests, he was averaging 51, right? Hmm. And so, you know, when was that? That was at the start of 2021, right? So that was the one thing I was asked that question quite a bit back in those days of like, you know, what is going on? And I couldn't work it out because there was no reason why he shouldn't take test wickets. And since then, he's played 11 matches, an average of 24. So a hell of a regression. Wow. Or is that the opposite of a regression? But
progression?
Yeah, but... Look, I think you're right. I'm trying to think of his T20 numbers a little bit more.
I mean, Saudi has amazing T20 numbers, but Tim Southee is a shadow of his former self at this point, right? He's not the same bowler.
Yeah, Tim Southee, you're probably, you know, I think Matt Henry probably has a similar problem to Tim Southee. They're probably quite both one-dimensional T20 bowlers in some ways. I think you're right. I think Henry has taken over. There was a spell he bowled against South Africa when I think South Africa were like 14 for 3 or something in must have been the first test of that series where I was just like people are going to be going on and on at the moment about how bad South Africa are because they might get bowled out for 50 here. But the truth was, I don't think anyone in the world would have laid bat on some of the balls he was bowling. His wobble ball, because of his pace and accuracy and energy. And also, I reckon his wobble ball goes further away from a right-hander than most do. I don't know what his splits are, you know, right hand versus left hand or anything like that. But just on my eye test of when I watch him, the amount of times I think, well, that's pinged away like a left arm finger spinner. Like, how the hell is anyone supposed to play that? I think he's a phenomenal bowler. And I was always interested, as I said, in just the fact that he wasn't taking any wickets before. It'd be great to go through, you know, CricViz or... even his ball-by-ball record to see if there was a reason why he struggled for so long. But certainly now he's a fantastic player. And you know, you talked about his, his batting. He's got great chaos batting to him, right? Like he really is one of those, you know, we had Lord Shardul make runs in the Ranji Trophy semi-final, I think it was this week. You know, that kind of energy of like, you can just come out and smash the ball. And I've seen Matt Henry do that a few times now. I really enjoy watching him bat in that kind of, you know, in that kind of mode, I suppose is the best way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to like about him as a cricketer, and, you know, maybe it just took him a little bit longer than other players, right, to bring all that together. He's probably not, although, I mean, it took Bolt a long time to be a really good, all format bowler, didn't he? Like, you know, Bolt's a much better white ball bowler now than he probably, although his one day bowling was always good, but he was probably a little bit more of a one-dimensional one ball bowler. White ball bowler as well. So I do think, you know, Henry maybe it's taken a little bit longer to work everything out, but I think he's a fantastic player. And I really enjoy watching him bowl. He's kind of very, very consistent with what he does. As I said before, there isn't really much that can go wrong with it. Like he's just going to land the ball more or less where he has to over and over again. I think he's been fantastic in the way that he's played. And I find his wobble ball, if you compare him to Scott Boland, who's another very wobble ball, Scott Boland is a little bit slower and you can probably get out of your crease too. And I found with Matt Henry, people have probably struggled a little bit just to change the length on him.
Yeah, it's interesting. People used to compare his action to Shane Bond. Of course, he did come up as one of those young bowlers who everyone thought will go a long way. I actually had the opportunity to speak to him. For those of you who want to check it out, I interviewed him for Grassroots Cricket. He mentioned how he had like a career-threatening injury. He has like a plate in his back or something like that. So to come back from that and still bowl at that good pace, really, really good action still, a joy to watch, and very, very clinical with the new ball, gets the ball to shape around a lot. I think it's a great story. And he mentioned in that interview that his time at Kent prior to the 2019 World Cup, where he spent a summer over there, that's where he was really able to hone his skills. So it's a great story. And I really hope that he goes on to do even more special things for New Zealand.
There's a lot of bowlers who played county cricket around that 2018-2019 period when the wobble ball was everywhere, that went from being very average players to exceptional players at that time. And so we know that the wobble ball, I think Peter Siddle in 2017, 2018 learns that, brings it back to Australia. So that was a really key period at which people are starting to do that. So I'm not surprised that if we have another county player, you know, international county player who went off and learned that.
Yeah, a fantastic bloke on top, which I suppose most of those New Zealand players are. They have that bit of a reputation. Speaking of weird instances, Jared, I don't know if you remember, but a few weeks ago on Uncovered, we had a super chat that mentioned Glenn Phillips as a genuine all-rounder, and we kind of laughed it off. Well, that dude, whoever sent that super chat, will have a wry smile on his face, because in this test match, Glenn Phillips scored a 70-ball 71, and then also took 5 for 45. And he'd done well in Bangladesh in the test matches. But you'd expect him to do well over there because, you know, the conditions suited his, you know, brand of cricketer, spin bowling, batting all-rounder. These conditions, not so much. And he's turning out to be a bit of a freak show because you don't expect these things from Glenn Phillips and he continues to do them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a randomness to the way he plays cricket that is sort of coming across. Although, as I said, Dane Peat and Nathan Lyon, Glenn Phillips, it seems that any off spinner can take a 5 wicket all in New Zealand suddenly. So I don't know what's going on with that. But look, I still don't think he's an all-rounder. I don't think he's consistent enough with the ball. I think he'll go through long periods. When we talk about someone who's an all-rounder, what we really mean is they have the ability to be that fifth bowler consistently and put pressure on if there's an injury or give you that, you know, great fifth bowler option. He's probably more in that Mark Waugh situation where occasionally you can throw him the ball and he's going to do something handy. I like the way he thinks as a bowler. I love the way he thinks as a cricketer in general, if we're being honest. But look, it's great that he's had some success because, you know, we've talked about him a lot on the here. You know how highly I rate his overall talent. Would love to see him, be consistently successful because I think he's a He's just a fun cricketer to watch. And so I was really excited that he took those wickets.
Yeah, Nathan Lyon described him as the Marnus of the New Zealand dressing room. So that's interesting. I never thought of him being that kind of overly chirpy character.
He's probably more manic than Marnus as well. Like, I mean, there's, Marnus is always talking and thinking. I think Glenn Phillips is talking, thinking and acting. Like, I think everything's happening at the same time with him.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that John Cena meme thing going on for him as well. They always put in the John Cena music whenever he comes out to bat or bowl. And yeah, Mookie has very rightly pointed out that he can keep as well. So in that regard, he is a very well-rounded cricketer. Interesting fun factoid is that at the Basin Reserve, he now has a 5-wicket haul, a 50, and has completed a stumping. So yeah. How's that for a complete set, right? Last thing I'd probably want to talk about with respect to New Zealand is that we've seen that they've kind of in the series established that Rachin Ravindra is going to be their number 4 batter. Now, he got a duck and a 59, so hot and cold sort of performance. But what I want to know is that, you know, Kane at 3, Rachin at 4, Daryl Mitchell at 5. That on paper looks like a very sturdy middle order. And of course, Devon Conway is injured now, but they've got quality players all across the board in the batting order. What happens to New Zealand when they face Australia?
I don't know. I mean, that. I've kind of toyed with it before, but what were they doing on that, was it second morning when Green and Hazelwood were back? So they had the field out when Green early in the over, but then later in the over, they weren't bringing all the fielders in, right? There were still easy singles to be found for him, and Green took them regularly. They didn't really go with, you know, bouncy Yorker strategies or wide ball strategies. They didn't seem to have one strategy that they ever were going with. And then they had Rachin Ravindra, who is another part-time spinner, bowling into the footmarks against a left-hander, Josh Hazelwood. And I'm like, okay, you know, I don't want to get too match-uppy here. The footmarks are like a day old in New Zealand. He's not about to, you know, Ravi Jadeja one back in from the Dust Bowl here. You've got a part-time left-arm finger spinner spinning the ball into a left-hander. It just, none of it made any sense. I thought it was obscenely stupid cricket. Like, actually, if they'd gone the England method, right, and they said to themselves, we're just going to bounce Green. We know it's short boundaries. We know he'll get a couple away. But we think if we just consistently bounce him, he'll eventually hit one straight up in the air. At least they would have bought a wicket for like 60 or 70 runs, right? Like, they didn't even try that at all. Yeah, what happens to New Zealand when they play Australia is, I think it's a fascinating conversation to be had. You know, they had that last team was probably the best team to play them in that last series. Mm. And it just doesn't work for them. And I you know, there's a line from, I forget the name of the sitter. I think it's Ryan Adams. There's Ryan Adams, not Brian Adams, but Ryan Adams, who I think has been cancelled as a singer now. But he has a line in one of his songs about inherited sadness. And I always wonder about that, about, you know, the Red Sox or, you know, Collingwood Football Club or, you know, Pakistan versus India. Like, how do you inherit that kind of record? Like, you should... There are just times when New Zealand should play better against Australia. And there are old guys in Australia, I promise you. Jim Maxwell, I think he's probably said this on the record, so I'm not throwing him under the bus. But if Australia is playing New Zealand in a knockout game or a World Test Championship final, whatever it may be, he would just say, well, there's no way they can beat them. And he's not saying that for effect. He genuinely believes there is no way that they will beat them. And the funny thing is, you know, I've talked to Mountain Crow and Jeremy Coney about this. They think Australian cricket's quite dumb, New Zealanders. They actually think that it's like reductive and that they don't really try anything and they just sit back and wait. Whereas in New Zealand, that, you know, they're like, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to try this. And yet when New Zealand play Australia, it just feels like it all falls apart every time. It's a remarkably shit record.
Yeah, every single time pretty much. And Gary Stead actually said that they failed to read the surface, and that's alarming because this is their home series. They shouldn't be failing to read the surface, right? They should know the conditions better. And you mentioned how they should have gone for a bouncer barrage versus Cam Green. Well, they got rid of the guy who does that, and they played Scott Kugelein ahead of him. But anyway, we'll come to that. There's a segment on that in Uncovered, yep. So we'll speak about Wagner and Kugelein. And I think that wraps up Australia versus New Zealand, and we have one more test match to look forward to. And on that note, we shall take a short break. You guys are watching Overthrows with Behram and Jared. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this ad. Welcome back to Overthrows, everybody. You with Behram and Jared. And after 6 years of playing their first test match, Jared, Ireland finally won one on their 8th attempt, and that too by 6 wickets versus Afghanistan in Abu Dhabi. So away from home, happy for them about that. Just how big is this? Because this is a nation that has, you know, done as much as it possibly can to stay relevant and improve with respect to their cricket and everything. And they don't nearly get as much opportunity to showcase their talent as much as they should. So this is huge.
Yeah, I don't think any team's made chasing 111. And getting their 4 wickets down more nervy than what Ireland did. Like, they played like a team who has been waiting for this opportunity for 200 years and were terrified they were going to ruin it. No, look, it's massive. It's cricket in Ireland. I'll give you a brief history lesson for those who don't know. You know, cricket in Ireland's been there since the 1700s. We know that for a fact. And, you know, there's really, you know, the Ulster Cricket Club in the 1800s, and, you know, certainly in Republic of Ireland, we can trace cricket back a long, long way. But around 1900, or I think it was 1900 exactly, the GAA, which is the local Irish sports, so hurling and Gaelic football and those kinds of sports, they basically said, you either play our sports or you don't play, or you go and play other sports, you can't play both. Right. And it was a huge moment for cricket, really, because if you go back, there's no reason why Ireland wouldn't have gone on to be a test playing nation. Who knows what would have happened with the Commonwealth stuff and all that sort of stuff. But on a very basic level, it really set cricket back in Ireland a long way. It meant the best athletes went into the Irish sports rather than playing in the other sports. And yet in 1969, they have this remarkable game where they roll the West Indies out for 25 on a green pitch with a couple of hungover West Indians who were, you know, are shocked. And, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s, depending on who you talk to, Scotland was better, right? And Scotland has always been considered to be a very decent cricket team. And obviously Scotland has produced test players for England, you know, going back to Douglas Jardine and Ian Peebles, like proper test cricketers. And that hasn't always been the case with Ireland up until very recently. And then in the 90s, things just changed, right? Like my cricket club in 1996 had Ed Joyce come over. And the reason Ed Joyce came over is one of our players went over to play professionally in Ireland because there was money on offer. And so many guys that I grew up with went over and played a season in Ireland. And you go and have a look and it's, you know, and then that's where the Trent Johnstons and all those sorts of guys come through and they start playing over there and they professionalize Irish cricket. There's a bit of money in the Irish economy because of the Celtic Tiger and all these different things. But the truth is that Irish cricket has been held up by the Joyce family and, you know, the O'Brien family and the Lewis family, you know, and you're talking, when I mean held up, I mean men's and women's, right? The Joyces play in both and the Lewis family is, you know, got members from the male and the female sides. It's incredible. And it was hard to play cricket. I think it was Ed Joyce who described that if you were seen with a cricket bag, was Ed Joyce or Owen Morgan? One of them talked about the fact that you were abused. And there's a term in Ireland called West Brit, which is basically their way of saying you're not really Irish, you're English. And cricketers were referred to this a lot of that time. And so, you know, for those families to keep it going and, you know, I've been lucky enough to, you know, hang out a little bit, at some of the games. I was at their first test match. It's just a joyous family cricket thing. And just on a professional level as well. They disbanded the old union-led cricket league and went independent before I think Cricket Australia and Cricket New Zealand did, if I remember correctly, or certainly around that period. And they went from not a test nation to a test nation within 10 years when none of us even knew who they were. You know, when I talking to Warren Dutrum, who's their long-term CEO, and he was telling me that when they first had offices, the next to them in the same office section was the wind. I think it was kite surfing or windsurfing as a sport, and they had more staff members looking after windsurfing than they did on cricket at that point. It was basically a CEO and an admin. I think the woman who worked for them was like 3 days a week or something, and that was the professional structure of Irish cricket at that point. So to get from there to where they are now, and you know, I've dealt with a lot of cricket boards. I've never dealt with a cricket board more open, more honest, more willing to help. Like, I've worked for Cricket Scotland. It's still tough for me to get Scottish players to agree to do interviews, right? Ireland, we were in 2012. Warren Dutrum sat down with me for an hour. Trent Johnson sat down with me for half an hour. And then we got Niall O'Brien to wrestle with our Hansi the Cronier Bear mascot for the old Two Chuck show. They've always thought about these things really, really differently. And it's a testament to everyone from all those amateurs for all those years to the professionals that have moved Irish cricket forward. And they had to work for this, right? I mean, they basically don't play test matches. How on earth are you supposed to get good at playing test matches when you don't play test matches? I don't know. And this was not an easy win for them. It wasn't a full strength Afghanistan side, let's be honest, but it's a good Afghanistan side. We all know that. You know, we've seen enough of them to know how good they were. And, you know, when they were, was it then they lost their third or their fourth wicket? You could see how
they were 39 for 4, chasing 111.
Yeah. And they were shitting themselves, let's be honest. Absolutely shitting themselves, right, from that point forward. And I'm sure I'll get Andy Bell Burney. I usually get him on when something's wrong. So this time I'll get it on when something's right. I'm sure he'll come on the podcast and, you know, I'd love for him to talk through the whole thing with us. But just a beautiful moment, I think, for cricket in general. To have that. And also, there's so many great things about Irish cricket, like the fact that their women's team played test cricket, you know, 18 years before their men's team did. And, you know, now they've got, you know, winners in men's and women's cricket. And it really is, it's a beautiful thing.
I think what truly kick-started, you know, the Irish cricket revolution was probably that win versus Pakistan at Sabina Park, 2007. Because, you know, so many of those players from that team went on to represent England. Right? Ed Joyce was actually playing for England at that point, but he came back to Ireland. And then Boyd Rankin played a test match for England, or maybe a couple. And Owen Morgan went on to captain them to a World Cup.
The interesting thing is that I think you're right. And obviously that changes things a lot. But if you go back, they just started to professionalize before then. And they were probably one of the first associate, like Netherlands, probably better than them for a long time. As I said, Scotland were better than them. You know, Afghanistan were coming through like a freight train, right? Kenya had already been really, really good. None of those other teams had worked out professionalism. And for whatever reason, Ireland did, you know, around that point. And they realized that something had to change. And maybe it was beating Pakistan that allowed them to dream that. But either way, like I remember dealing with Scotland in 2015 World Cup. And you can imagine Scotland and Ireland, there's a pretty big rivalry there. And I kept saying, why are you guys just not doing what Ireland did? And they were so upset that A, I kept pointing that out, but also B, that they weren't doing it. And it sounds silly now, but the difference, I would say that the quality of cricket in Scotland is probably still slightly higher than the quality of cricket in Ireland. And yet, look at where Ireland have now won a test themselves, and Scotland are still not, you know, don't have test status. It really shows you all the little things they got right. And as you said, that magical win against Pakistan really helped things. But let's not forget the Kevin O'Brien win, and then 2015 World Cup, when they were just, when they played brilliant cricket in that 2015 World Cup, right? And we get frustrated when they've gone down and the golden generation's disappeared. And, you know, I covered that test in 2018. And let's be honest, there was a few guys holding on just so they could play in that first test match. You know, no names. Ed, Gary, you can hear me. But, you know, but they deserved it, those guys, right? Like, just to go back to the Ed Joyce story. So he comes out to play in my club. We didn't know Ireland played cricket, right? How many people in the 90s knew that Ireland had a history of cricket and were any good at it? And to go from that to being a test playing nation who's won a test in Abu Dhabi, in conditions that are, let's be honest, not Irish, I think is a magnificent effort.
Yeah, I remember back in that World Cup, there was this story that a lot of those guys, or at least some of those guys in that squad, had to take more time off from work because, you know, they had qualified for the next round. And you forgot the West Indies win in the T20 World Cup as well. I believe they knocked them out in one of those T20 World Cups. So they've had their moments versus Pakistan, versus England, versus the West Indies. And they continue to, you know, chart new heights. And this is a big one. You caught a bit of that final day's play, or well, whatever it was, day four. And when they were 39 for four, chasing 111, and, of course, Captain Andy Bell Burney, who, you know, led them to the end, scored an unbeaten 58. And Lachlan Tucker, who scored runs in both innings. How good were they to kind of weather that storm and take Ireland through that passage of play? Because Afghanistan spin bowlers, whoever they play, they're always tough.
I think it was the quicks who had them in more trouble, weirdly enough. They had the... they had the three, the two quicks, and the ball was nipping around a little bit. You know, some good wobble ball bowling, you know, at pace, keeping that off stump, middle stump in play quite a bit. You know, that sort of Asian Pakistani seam bowling or Indian seam bowling style. That was, I think, when the quick bowlers got tired is actually when Ireland got slightly back on top. They were unlucky, not unlucky, but the left arm finger spinner, whose name I've forgotten from Afghanistan.
Ziaur Rahman.
Yes. He ragged a couple, but the one he got Sterling on kind of was off the face of the bat. Like it was more of a mistake from Sterling. And outside of that, you know, I thought it was the seamers who had them in trouble. And then there was a couple of half shouts. Some things could have gone against Ireland that would have put the pressure back on them. And they still had Andy McBrien, the pinch blocker, to come in. So they had a little bit of batting left to go. And Mark Adair can obviously slog them. And, you know, they weren't going to fold up. But one more wicket, I think, really, really would have been interesting in that game. But once they got in against the spinners and they kind of, Balbirnie sort of accepted he was just going to play and miss at some of those because they were the ball was spinning. And Lorcan Tucker, as he does, just decided to sweep every single ball that he faced. They put a bit, little bit of pressure back, and then Afghanistan had to bring Zahir Khan on, the left arm wrist spinner, not the former Indian player. and that was always a chance that the game was going to go very quickly in one direction or the other because Zahir Khan is not the most accurate bowler and, you know, also kept bowling no balls, which didn't particularly help. But it really wasn't until they were about 30 runs from the total that I thought Ireland looked settled. Up until that point, I still thought if they'd lost a wicket, it could have been a bit of a battle on the way all the way through. But, you know, they're not the first team to kind of crawl their way to victory in a test match because, you know, it's not a natural thing. These guys don't play a lot of it, and this meant a lot to all those players involved. You know, I interviewed Andy Balbirnie during lockdown, and I called him the Ireland test captain, which he was. And he was like, well, I haven't actually captained a test yet. And, you know, it's a completely different world what they play compared to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, what, 8 test matches in roughly 6 years and then these tours in which there's just a solitary test match? I just don't get it.
Most of the test matches have been in the last 12 months too, haven't they? Have they had 4 or 5 in the last? I mean, they played Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Afghanistan. Am I missing another one in there as well?
They've only ever played a test series in which there were 2 test matches. Otherwise, it's always been those solitary test matches. Yeah. And that was against Sri Lanka. So that's what really like pisses me off personally, because there's no point of inducting new members as test nations if you're not going to give them test cricket. Because, you know, how can they accumulate enough caps to build that experience? How can they know more about each other as a unit, how to win test matches if they're just not going to play enough? I'm pretty upset that, you know, teams like New Zealand and Pakistan and the likes get to play like 6 to 7 test matches a year. These guys are, you know, solitary test match series. That's just not on. I mean, they've got to fix this.
I mean, they had their chance. They should have had a 2-division system where, you know, top 7 teams played and the next 7 teams played. They didn't even have to call the other games test matches. They could have had, you know, Netherlands or Namibia or Scotland or whoever playing as in that second division to try and get test status. And instead, we're in a situation where we call these teams test nations and they don't play all that much. And, you know, it's very, very unfortunate, but it was great that it was an exciting game right down to the end. You know, Afghanistan had plenty of chances to win that game as well. It was a really entertaining, messy test. It was on YouTube as well, which meant that you could watch it from anywhere in the world. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I love these low scorers because, you know, when I looked at the scorecard, there were like 4 guys in 4 innings who crossed 50 and the highest score was Balbirnie's 58. Yeah. And I love that. Those are the real nail biters. You mentioned how, you know, the seam bowlers were doing things. That does kind of make sense because the player of the match was right-arm seamer Mark Adair. He took 5 wickets in the first innings and then 3 in the third. And he was the one who ultimately inspired his nation to a maiden test win. What do you have to say about him?
I wonder where Mark Adair would be if he played probably, I don't want to say more counter cricket, but more counter cricket or more international cricket of a higher level. I feel like I think Mark Adair's best ball is absolutely top level international quality ball. but he doesn't bowl it enough and he does struggle. You know, Mark Adair can move the ball both ways in the air, right? Mm-hmm. And he can also get it to nip around a little bit off the wobble as well. There aren't that many bowlers in the world who can do that at 85, 88 miles an hour, right? Like, he has a lot of skills going for him. But then there are other days when he just seems to bowl every second ball down the leg side. He hasn't been able to match that. And I don't know if that's development of the Irish system. I don't know if that's how he would have been in any system. But, you know, he's got – his best ball is definitely international quality. I think this is a really important step for him. Perhaps he spent so much of his time bowling in Ireland and England – what he probably might have needed was bowling more in T20 cricket on flat wickets and maybe bowling more in places like Asia where you have to just be more accurate or smarter or whatever it is that he needs. But I think his talent level is really, really high, and he certainly played a huge part in this victory.
Yeah, he had 10 wickets in 4 test matches prior. Now he has 18 in 5. So that 8 for not only has got Ireland their maiden test win, but also propelled his numbers by a certain degree.
And I promise you, I've seen him play in some of those other test matches as well. He's played on slightly better, more conducive wickets to what he does than this one.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Okay, just to wrap this up, of course, you mentioned him earlier. One of the big positives for Afghanistan in this test match was left-arm orthodox spinner Ziaur Rahman. He took 6 wickets in total, including 5 for 64 in his first dig. And I was checking his first-class numbers. He actually has 165 wickets in 30 games at less than 20 apiece. And his List A and T20 records also hold up. But of course, there's lots of competition in those limited overs teams in Afghanistan when it comes to spin bowling. But in the longest format, this guy could be an asset. He's only 26 right now.
I mean, Afghanistan is 26. look, he spins it a long way. He's got a bit of an interesting action. He doesn't have much of a front arm. Sort of comes around a little bit more, so puts a lot of side spin on the ball. I was impressed with him. I saw him bowl a little bit in the first innings. Obviously saw him bowl almost all of his overs in the second innings. I thought he was very good. I thought he got his length slightly wrong on a slower pitch, and he needed to later in that game toss it up a little bit more. And I felt he was a little bit one-dimensional as a bowler, but that one dimension is landing the ball pretty much where he wants it every ball and ragging it sideways. Like, it's a good dimension to have. but he did look, he looked a little bit one-dimensional, but I could see why he would absolutely tear up first-class cricket. Because you could see Andy Balburny having to work his way through against a bowler like that. And as I said, Lorcan Tucker kind of put him off with the sweeps a little bit more. But I thought he bowled really, really well. There's something there. Be interesting to see how he goes outside of Asia. He looks like, to me, a very Asian spinner. I'm not sure how much it will translate outside, but he does put proper revs on the ball. So that's always a good start.
Yeah, we'll see how he fares and how many test matches he ends up playing in total.
That's also true.
Yeah, there's that. But anyway, that wraps up Overthrows in just under 45 minutes. That's a new record, Jared. And thank you to everyone who joined us in the comments section. And if you enjoyed this podcast, like this video and subscribe to both this channel and Jared's other channel. We'll be back with another episode of the Overthrows podcast next week. That's all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.